welcome to Addicted to Murder. This is Courtney, licensed professional counselor with over a decade of experience.
And this is Trisha, and I'm really glad that banks are not like Nexums.
Nexums? Isn't that that weird cult?
It's not Nexium. This is N-U-X-U-M, and it's an ancient form of loan in which the creditor could kill the debtor if he failed to make his payments.
Oh. Yeah, I'm also glad banks are not that way.
Although there'd be a lot less probably like bogus loans and foreclosures and such.
That's people true. People
took it very seriously.
That's what true. Would happen.
Mm-hmm. That's like old school loan shark justice right there.
Definitely.
Like Tony Soprano type of shit.
Right. Or like almost like biblical.
Yeah.
Old Testament stuff.
Did you watch The Sopranos?
I watched some of it.
You didn't get into it? It's violent.
Yeah. I was a little too young when it was out, like, originally. So then I think I just, like, sort of missed it.
I love mafia stuff. Mm. I think it's fascinating. And one of these days we'll do something on some mob person.
Probably.
But, like, all of the... Especially there's so many good movies that are based on true stories.
You know, that's
like
true.
Goodfellas or, like, Donnie Brasco or...
Right.
Not The Godfather. Although I did watch the... They did a Netflix documentary, not documentary, but a mini series like on the trouble they had with The Godfather making it. Because I guess it was a big controversy.
Interesting.
The mafia did not like that being portrayed that way. Like Frank Sinatra had issues with it and everything. Oh, I can't remember what it's called, but it was really good.
Okay. I think I know what you're talking about, but I don't know what it's called either.
Yeah. Shoot. It'll come to me. But anyways.
Interesting.
We're back after our hiatus.
We are. Thank you for being patient with us. We needed that little break.
Yes. While we were on break, Courtney and I went to the Newport Wine and Seafood Festival.
Which was super fun. Ate lots of crab.
Got away for the weekend and it was actually nice.
I know. Oregon coast nice in February.
Yeah, it was super pretty. And we tried lots of wine. Might have been the most wine Courtney's ever had.
Quite possibly.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you're not like a
Definitely the most
by trade.
Yeah, definitely the most variety of wine I've ever had.
Yeah, it was a good time. We rented a condo right on the bay, and we did post some pictures on Instagram. You guys might have saw it if you follow us at Addicted to M Podcast on Instagram.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I was listening to some of our old episodes and how we used to always throw all that shit at the beginning.
Oh, okay. And then we threw it all at the end
for
a while.
Yeah. It was better at the end. But yes. The thing about the beginning is that people had to listen to it.
Exactly.
Or fast forward it. So anyways, we don't really do it much anymore. We're like, either like us or you don't.
Right.
We've given up on trying to make money for the most part on this thing. I think last year with like our ad revenue, I think it ended up being like $11 overall.
Right. But hey, that is more money than most people who have a podcast make.
Yeah. I mean, who knows? Maybe someday someone will want to sponsor us.
Right. Yeah. Tell your friends. We need like 10,000 listeners per episode.
Yeah. We're not anywhere near there. Anyway, we're lamenting. We're moving on. We have a new case, but I also have a question.
Go ahead.
Well, Chris and I are in the middle of kind of updating our house. And we got the interior painted, and I bought flooring, but it's going to take a while for us to put it in because we're going to try to do it ourselves, and it's a big job.
Mm-hmm.
Courtney, you bought a bit of a fixer-upper yourself.
Did.
And I'm just curious, what's the first thing that you want to tackle when you have the time and the money to do so?
Inside the house, definitely the floors.
Mm-hmm. You have hardwood, right?
We have hardwood downstairs and carpet upstairs. And all of the floors is really damaged from the previous owners and water damage and pet damage. And they just all need to be replaced.
Do you want hardwood or carpet?
Hardwood.
Okay. Yeah. Carpet is, I mean, I get that. Carpet is so much cheaper and they install it for free.
Right. Mm. But
they
it's
do not install vinyl plank for free. So
they
expensive.
Don't. No. But we have cats that are, you know, like to puke on things. Yeah. And it's much easier to clean up a hardwood floor.
It is.
Or a laminate floor than carpet.
I mean, that's why we're going for it. But at the same time, I'm like, oh my God, if we got carpet, it would be a quarter of the cost and they'd install it for us.
It's true.
But oh well.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that was just what I was wondering.
It's a good question.
Thank you. Courtney did choose this killer. And you said you just sort of, you knew the name, but you didn't really know much about it. So
right. Yeah, I'd heard the name before, thrown around, but didn't know the story.
Okay. And I think I heard of his moniker, not his name. But anyways, so it is Paul John Knowles or the Casanova Killer.
Yes.
Dun, dun, dun. And the book that we're using for most of this research is called Drop Dead Gorgeous, The Lethal Attraction of Road Trip Killer Paul John Knowles by Ryan Green.
It's Drop Dead Dangerous.
Oh, shit. That is what it says. I can read. Hello. Anyway, so he has two monikers. The Road Trip Killer.
And the Casanova Killer.
The Casanova Killer. Casanova Killer is a cooler one.
It is, but the Road Trip Killer kind of like actually fits the story better.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He is a good looking guy.
Yes.
So, I don't know if you guys want to look him up or not. I mean, we'll obviously post a picture of him. But, yeah. So, Drop Dead Gorgeous by Ryan Green.
Drop Dead Dangerous.
That is a movie, Drop Dead Gorgeous.
It is. It is.
Oh, my gosh. I'm going to stop. I'm going to stop talking about it, apparently. I just don't want to say that word. All right. So, anyways. Yeah, so he wanted to be famous. So, it's weird that there's so little known about him, as far as like most people maybe have heard the name but don't know anything about it, because like that was like his goal at the end,
right?
It's kind of weird, but anyways, comments. Yeah. Courtney,
well, I think, you know, if it weren't for the way that Paul's story ends, I do think that Paul could have had like that similar level of infamy as his main contemporary, Ted Bundy, who was, they were killing right around the same time.
Yeah, and they sort of have some of the stuff seems similar.
Right.
I mean, not their childhoods by any means, but some of the other things that happen later in life.
Right. Remind exactly. Each other.
All right. So let's get started. Paul John Knowles was born in Orlando, Florida on April 25th, 1946. And he would later claim that, quote, being born was the worst mistake he ever made. He's slightly melodramatic.
He's very nihilistic.
Mm-hmm. There you go. He was a troublemaker from the get-go. He had four siblings, and they lived in a small apartment. Paul also claimed that he felt that his parents loved him, but they didn't really pay attention to him, and they didn't take care of the kids that they had produced. So they were pretty much neglected. They weren't clean. They weren't fed properly, and they kind of did whatever they wanted to do. So it was almost like after they were babies, their parents were over them, and that sort of reminds me a little bit about of Diane Downs. What do you think, Courtney?
You know, I think many people focus on like physical and sexual abuse. And while those things are awful, the most impactful kind of child abuse is actually neglect. And that's backed up by research. When children experience physical neglect, like not having adequate food or safe shelter, not only do they learn to resort to desperate measures to get those needs met, but their brain development can actually be impacted by like lack of proper nutrition. And then emotional neglect leaves lasting marks on children regarding their ability to form healthy attachments to others, learn empathy, and learn how to solve problems.
And we know that not having empathy is a bad thing.
Yes.
At least for others.
It is.
Maybe not so much for the person. Well, so naturally the kids sort of learned their morals, so to speak, on the street. This led them to being truant. In fact, a truant officer was the only one that made them go to school. Most likely without that enforcement, it sounds like the kids would not have attended school at all. When Paul did get forced into going to school, he fought at school, but he won the fights. And his brother speculated that was due to the violence he experienced at home and perhaps also what he experienced on the streets. Paul's father was a harsh disciplinarian. All of the children suffered the wrath of their father, but for whatever reason, Paul got the brunt of the beatings. Paul did steal to feed himself and his siblings, and he grew to be defiant. He didn't listen to any authority figures. Maybe it was rebellion against his father's treatment. I don't know. I guess father and son fought nearly every day, and he was beaten with a belt, and he even got a broken nose one time from his father. Courtney, why do you think some parents single out a single child to be the main punching bag? Can you also talk a little bit more about what this type of physical abuse can do to a child? We need a refresher.
So often in families, especially dysfunctional ones, people tend to fall into specific roles. And one of the roles that children can fall into is that of the scapegoat. So the scapegoated child is singled out as the one causing the problems and taking the blame for pretty much any problem in the family, even though that's obviously not the case. And sometimes, unconsciously, a child may accept being in this role as a way of protecting younger or weaker siblings from abuse. So I wonder if, you know, Paul, as the oldest, maybe took that on to protect his siblings a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then as for the impact of physical abuse at the hands of a parent, it can do a lot of damage, as we know. Children who are physically abused often experience low self-worth, fear and resentment of authority figures, and learn that violence is an appropriate response to anger or a way to gain power.
Well, at one time, Paul got busted by the cops after he stole a bike from another kid, and this actually resulted in a fine that was given to his parents, and this was not well received by his father. In fact, he disowned Paul at this point because Paul had cost him money, and that was not okay. So, Courtney, I have to ask if you know how this works or if you've ever worked with a kid that has been disowned at a young age. It seems like a criminal offense to abandon your kids, basically. And I realize this was long ago, but do you have any experience with this?
So, I don't know specifically about the laws in Florida, especially back in the 1950s, but in modern-day Oregon, abandoning a child under the age of 15 is considered a Class C felony. So, it is against the law, and is considered child abuse. And, you know, I have worked with clients who have been kicked out by their parents or left in the care of other relatives or foster families without further contact. And often, you know, this is related to parent substance abuse, but not always. And one common thing that comes up for children who are abandoned by their parents is a belief that they are unlovable and unwanted. And, you know, being rejected by a parent just leaves a big hole that nothing else can really fill.
So you're saying that, like, you can't disown a kid under 15 in Oregon, technically, legally?
Yes.
As far as you know?
Yes.
Okay. There might be some weird situations, but it would most likely have to be an emancipation, which it would be hard for a 15-year-old to prove they could take care of themselves.
Right. Like, a parent could theoretically, like, agree to give up their custodial rights in order for someone else to take on those custodial rights.
But they can't just, like, kick them out and not have care set up for them.
Right.
Okay. And yes, I can see how if your parent did that to you, you would be, like, totally crushed inside and thinking you were unlovable.
Yeah. I mean.
Mm-hmm. Well, back then he was put into the care of the state. That's what happened to him. And he entered a group home. Of course, he was rebellious. So Paul now had stable food and a bed, but it may have been too late for him, and he did not want to follow rules. There was a curfew, but he ignored it, and he was able to get into the home anyhow by breaking in. He was well-versed in picking locks at this point. If he couldn't get in, he just slept outside. It seemed like he really didn't care about being looked after, and at a very young age, he had figured out how to take care of himself. So, Courtney, I imagine at this point, Paul has conduct disorder. Any other diagnosis you want to throw out? I'm not sure what it is, but I have heard of an oppositional defiant disorder, and this just kind of sounds like something he'd have as well.
Yeah, so oppositional defiant disorder and conduct disorder are in the same category in the DSM-5. Oppositional defiant disorder is a diagnosis typically given to children or teens who exhibit behaviors like being argumentative, refusing to follow adult directions, angry outbursts, and vindictive behaviors towards others when they're angry. And at times, the opposition to authority goes so far that children will refuse to do things that they enjoy or benefit them if they are told that they have to. It's kind of like an automatic response that happens. And so ODD, as oppositional defiant disorder is called, is often a learned response to an environment that has been both controlling and does not meet a child's needs at the same time, which kind of sounds like his upbringing a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so the main difference between ODD and conduct disorder is the presence of criminal behavior. Mm. It's common for children to be diagnosed first with ODD and then to have that change to conduct disorder after they cross that line into criminal behaviors. And yes, you're right. Paul would have met criteria for conduct disorder at this point.
Okay. Well, Paul would be bounced around these group homes and orphanages several times. He got into physical altercations with other residents and staff because violence just came naturally to him at this point. When it was clear that he could not be kept at the homes he was constantly being transferred to, he was placed somewhere more intense, somewhere worse, somewhere much worse. And it was called the Arthur G. Dozer School for Boys, a.k.a. the Florida Industrial State School for Boys. Now, when Courtney and I discussed this case, she said we should talk about this infamous school for boys, and she did some research and watched some documentaries, and so I'm just going to let you take it away.
All right. So first, I want to give credit to the two documentaries that I watched that provided a lot of this information about the Florida School for Boys, which is how I'm just going to refer to it. So the first one is called Boys' School, and the second one is called Deadly Secrets, The Lost Boys of Dozier. So when Paul was there, the school was known as the Florida School for Boys. It was opened in the year 1900, and boys between the ages of 5 and 18 were sent there for, you know, rehabilitation, essentially. Many boys were sent there for tiny infractions like trespassing, truancy, or running away from home. The Florida School for Boys had a strong racist history, with approximately 75% of its residents being Black, and the facility was racially segregated for much of its history. And there's a whole lot that the documentary goes into about the way that, you know, being in the South and the way that, like, racism and the effects of, you know, the Jim Crow laws and all of that kind of impacted that. Mm-hmm. So if you're interested in that piece of it, definitely recommend.
I'm going to watch these. I meant to watch these prior to recording, and it slipped away from me.
Yeah, they're very interesting.
Okay.
So the boys in the residence were forced into child labor while they were there, and that included actually building the facilities, working the farm to grow their food, and working in one of the many businesses run by the school on the property, such as, like, making shoes or sewing clothing garments or things like that. There were reports of mistreatment and abuse throughout the school's tenure, but the most severe abuse seemed to have take place during the 1950s and 1960s.
Was that when he was there, right?
That is when he was there, yep. During this time, the boys were subjected to severe beatings with wooden and leather paddles. One survivor recalled a time when he received 150 lashes with a paddle, resulting in bruises, cuts, and a broken tailbone.
Survivor. That's what they're calling them.
100%.
Not former inmate or whatever. Nope,
these were children, right? And so these beatings reportedly happened in a notorious building on the campus known as the White House. Survivors also report being taken to a basement referred to as the, quote, rape room, where they would be gang raped by staff. And remember, these are boys that are mostly between the ages of 10 and 16. And oftentimes they were receiving these punishments for talking back, for, you know, not doing their schoolwork properly, for cursing. Very small infractions would lead to these pretty intense beatings.
And rapes,
right. And often kids would be kind of pulled out of their beds in the middle of the night and dragged into the White House, sometimes not even knowing what it was for. So children who tried to run away from the facility were chased by staff who would shoot at them with shotguns as if they were prisoners. Mm-hmm. And, you know, several kids did get shot and died trying to run away from the place. And so looking at the history, while the real number, I imagine, is much, much higher, during its history, the Florida School for Boys had reported 31 reported student deaths. And they had a little cemetery on the campus where they were buried. Mm-hmm. But then when the school was investigated after its closure, they actually found 55 graves. And they used ground-penetrating radar to find those. And most of these graves were unmarked and we didn't know who was in them. Mm-hmm. And so if you watch the Deadly Secrets documentary. It's actually about the woman, I think she's an anthropologist at University of Florida, that is working to identify these boys using genetic genealogy and things like that. Uh-huh. That's just an aside. So, legally, physical and corporal punishment was banned at the school in the late 1960s. But there was continued to be report of abuse and mistreatment all the way up until the school was finally closed in 2011, which is not that long ago.
Right. No, 13 mm-hmm. years ago. Mm-hmm. Am I doing my math right?
Right.
I couldn't read today, so. So I want to just say that this book that we're using, a lot of it is from, like, Paul's perspective and stuff. Mm-hmm. So we're going to talk about a little bit what he said happened at the school, but it can't totally be verified. But again, the school obviously was not telling the truth about what right. was happening anyway. So we'll just go with that. He was telling the truth at this point.
Yeah.
Because that's what we got to do.
And his story matches a lot of what, you know, the survivors that have come forward now report.
Yeah. Yeah. So based on the book, the average stay at this school was 6 months. Mm-hmm. Paul was there for 3 years. From ages 15 to 18, he suffered horrific abuse that must have warped his already combative and traumatized mind. To iterate further how ghastly the school was, his final year in the school, 1/3 of the boys that were enrolled either went missing or they died. So that's 33.3% of a reform school's population was never heard from again, either by death or just simply vanishing. What the actual fuck? I think we can surmise that Paul may have been feeling extremely tough and street smart to keep himself alive in the school. It was perhaps a superhuman feat being still living as a resident who stayed 5 times longer than the average kid. Courtney, what must have happened to Paul's mind and soul when he was finally released at age 18? What was released onto the world?
So, like we said earlier, Paul was at the FSB during the time of the most severe abuse that was recorded. And in order to survive, Paul had to find a way to separate himself from the pain, likely through dissociating. And by the time he was released, he was completely desensitized to violence and pain. It didn't affect him anymore. There was no hope of living a life without pain and suffering for him. He would have been so broken down by being told over and over that he was worthless and unloved and broken down by the constant abuse. And, you know, when it came to making bad choices after he left there, there's no consequence that could possibly be worse than he had already experienced. So there was nothing to lose.
And that's a scary place for mm-hmm. the rest of us.
Right.
For someone to be.
Yeah, he has no fear. Mm-mm. There's nothing for him to lose because he's already lost everything.
Yeah, he has no family that seems to care about him. You know, he ended up at this school ultimately because they discarded him.
Exactly, you know? They threw him away.
Right, and whether or not his parents realized what would happen to him, I don't know. But he was a kid and he had no choice but to go to this school.
Right.
And anyhow. All right, so now we have a severely fucked up young adult who was probably institutionalized and has no concept of morality or what love feels like. And basically, he was dropped off on the street with nothing. Like, he didn't even know it was his 18th birthday. And as soon as he turned 18 and the state stopped paying for his upkeep, mm-hmm. so to speak, they dropped him off just on the street. No money, nothing. He didn't know what to do. He was waiting to be yelled at, beat, worse, whatever. And when he realized that wasn't going to happen, he had another problem. Like, what does he do with his freedom? So he just started to walk. He had no money, but he could remedy that. Remember, he was good at picking locks and breaking into houses. So that's what he did. He would rob people when they were not at home. Now, he didn't hurt anyone. He just got what he needed to get by. Sometimes he would steal a car when he felt like he overstayed his welcome in town. So in the book somewhere, it said he learned how to drive when he was like 12 or 13, something like that. So he would drive that car until it ran out of gas, and then he'd ditch it and steal another. Sometimes he'd rob a house. Sometimes he'd pick pockets. He would hit up pawn shops and just kind of aimlessly move from place to place. Paul at this time started to hook up with women. He was a good-looking guy. I'm assuming that's how he got his moniker, the Casanova Killer. Anyways, his good looks warranted him unwarranted attention from the staff and other residents at Dozier. That sounds weird. that sentence was weird. Basically, what I'm trying to say is while he was at Dozier, he was a good looking guy. So that got him extra, I guess, rape attention from the staff at Dozier.
He was targeted more.
Yeah. So at this point, because he was a good looking guy, he was getting with the women. His confidence was growing. He got more bold in his burglaries. He was breaking windows and stuff like that, being, you know, less careful, I guess. Paul was making pretty good money with these thefts. He was able to buy what he wanted. He could get the girls he wanted. He could rent a room when he wanted. He ate good food and he bought nice clothes. I guess the women thought that he was a rock star because of his looks and charisma. Like, they really thought he was someone famous. Courtney?
I mean, Paul was a survivor and he knew how to use the gifts and skills that he had for sure.
Yeah. His luck ran out one day when he was pulled over by a cop and... This is crazy what he did, but he grabbed the cop's gun and then proceeded to kidnap the officer and took off. So he gets pulled over. The cop's not really, I guess, super alert. Paul just grabs his firearm, forces him in the car, and then takes off with the cop. Not sure what he's going to do with the cop, but whatever. Unfortunately for Paul, the cop had called in the stop before Paul forced him in the car. And so he was caught not long after. And when he realized he was busted, he just pulled over calmly. He didn't resist arrest. He was charged with kidnapping. And due to the fact that he was able to grab a service weapon from an officer and then force him into the car, the arrest was kept quiet. And I imagine it was because it was maybe humiliating to the police department, you know. So due to this, he actually didn't spend that much time in jail. He was put into a low security prison because they didn't want him in a maximum security prison in case he told the other prisoners what he did and how he did it. So Courtney, this was his like first criminal act as an adult for which he was caught. Anything you want to comment on?
You know, I imagine it maybe came as a bit of a surprise when he got caught, as he'd been so successful in getting away with his crimes for so long. But then again, his resignation and acceptance during his arrest speaks to the conditioning he had from the Florida School for Boys.
Yeah. You know, yeah, him not being combative in that situation, I wonder if that was kind of beaten out of him, you know, mm-hmm. the authority figure standing up to him. Do you know what I mean?
That idea of, like, resistance is futile. Yeah. If you resist, it's just going to be worse for you.
Yeah. Because mm-hmm. we'll see that's a trend where he just doesn't put up a fight mm-hmm. for the most part. So, anyhow, compared to his time at Dozier or the Florida School for Boys, this prison was paradise. He was expecting to be beaten and raped and forced to do things that were unspeakable, and that is not what he experienced. He was in for a few months, and then he was released. When he was released, he promptly broke into a house, burglarized, and stole a car. He then left the town ASAP before that crime could be connected to him. So over the next few years, Paul would continue his criminal life, and he would occasionally get picked up by the police for his petty crimes and do some time in a local jail. At this time, his crimes were still nonviolent offenses. You know, back then, computers didn't really exist to do much of the, you know, so the cops couldn't, like, totally see his full record. So he was treated pretty well, all things considered. He was very personable, and the police seemed to like him for the most part. In 1970, though, things began to change. His crime started to escalate. And in 1971, he burglarized a home and actually tied up the resident. This got him 3 years in the slammer. He was sentenced to hard labor. A year into his sentence, he created himself a lock-picking kit and opened his cell door with it, and he just walked out of that camp. The guards didn't realize he was missing for hours. By the time he had hiked far away from the prison and found himself a car, clothes, and some cash was when they figured it out. And he did get caught, but it was because they threw up roadblocks, and he, as usual, didn't put up a fight. At this point in his criminal career, he was now being seen more of a dangerous person, and the police were not quite as friendly to him. Courtney?
Like many of the serial killers that we've discussed, Paul was charming, charismatic, good-looking, and intelligent. And so these traits mixed together with a criminal mind can be a very dangerous combination.
So the guards wanted to break Paul, you know, he wasn't combative, but he also didn't give a shit about anything. So they really couldn't get him to do what they wanted because there was nothing they could do to him or take away from him to get him to do what they wanted him to do. So
right. He'd already had the worst done.
Yeah. Anyways, he was just apathetic to everyone. So anyways, they figured out something, though, when they started this pen pal program. And he found a person in this pen pal program that he came to care very much about. So that was something that he actually cared about. And then the police could, or the cops, or excuse me, the guards could manipulate him to change his behavior and all this stuff. So like if he did something bad, they would withhold his mail. And that just made him do what he was told. He became a really good prisoner. And one of the pen pals stuck out through this program, and her name was Angela Kovic. And this is where the real trouble begins. But this is also where we're going to end.
Right.
Yeah.
A big turning point for him.
Yep. She is like Ted Bundy's college girlfriend.
Yes.
That's what I have in my mind.
Kind of a similar thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
The catalyst sort yep. of for it all.
Yep. And that's one of the things that remind me of Ted Bundy. But anyways, we'll talk more about this next time.
We will.
All right. Anything you say?
Nope. I feel good.
All right. Well, thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you next Tuesday.
Bye.
Bye.